As film and television viewers, we are all part-time residents of the highly populated cities of Time Warner, DirecTV, AMC, Sky, Comcast, ABC, Odeon, and so forth. And yet not all of these cities' architecture is televisual or cinematic by nature. Rather, these cities are also made up of all manner of ads, previews, trailers, interviews with creative personnel, internet discussion, entertainment news, reviews, merchandising, guerrilla marketing campaigns, fan creations, posters, games, DVDs, CDs, and spin-offs. Hype and synergy abound, forming the streets, bridges, and trading routes of the media world, but also many of its parks, beaches, and leisure sites.
Since the advent of the internet, film and television have expanded their reach considerably, from the streaming video of Hulu to pirated versions of new feature films to an array of trailers, advertisements, and product lines. What do they do for you, the viewer? And what does this proliferation of promotion portend for the future of the film and TV industry? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
In what way is all that hype useful? Is there a way to decode it in order to distinguish worthwhile viewing from all that other stuff? Are the lines blurring between what is and what isn't a film or a TV show? And what do film-based action figures and video games do for the TV viewer and filmgoer? Our guest is Jonathan Gray, professor of Media and Cultural Studies in the Communication Arts Department of the UW-Madison. He's also the author of Show Sold Separately, Promos, Spoilers, and Other Media Paratexts, published in 2010 by New York University Press.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the title of your book, Show Sold Separately, Promos, Spoilers, and Other Media Paratexts.
Yeah.
I know you spend some time in your introduction talking about what a paratext is and defining words like hype and trailer and all that. Why don't you give us some sense of the title, Show Sold Separately, and what the different terms are going to mean?
Well, the Show Sold Separately was just meant to sort of suggest playfully, I hope, that quite often we can look at the television show itself or the film itself, and yet they're also surrounded by all these other things. And I wanted to suggest that those other things sometimes are the thing itself. And so when we talk about The Simpsons, it's kind of hard just to separate off what The Simpsons TV show is. Or when we talk about Star Wars, we're always also talking about the hype. All of these things that surround film and TV are really what I'm interested in. And they're often called paratexts, at least in literary theory, meaning sort of all those things outside of what we consider that the text itself or the thing itself. So in books, we look at everything from book covers to, you know, the preface to, you could even say, the typeface that the book is in or the type of paper it's printed on. And certainly the first use of the word paratext comes from Gerard Genette, who is a literary theorist. But if we apply them to film and TV, we can think about things like DVD bonus materials. We can think about trailers, the opening credit sequences. We can think about reviews, sort of interviews that happen, whether they're in podcasts or whether they're on Jay Leno or Dave Letterman, so forth. All those things that surround and give us messages and try to create meaning about the film or TV show, but that aren't in the sort of hour and a half of the film itself or the 45 minutes per week of the TV show itself.
And sometimes, if we're thinking in terms particularly of something like a prequel, those paratexts can blur the storyline. In other words, they can contradict something that you've already seen in the character development or storyline of a thing like Star Trek, for example.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the rage in Hollywood right now to do reboots, right? So we had James Bond rebooted, and apparently Spider-Man's going to be rebooted, and the re-envisioning and the remaking of pretty much everything. And yet with each of those, you know, certain changes sometimes happen. And so we're left sort of wondering where's the canon in the center of this. And certainly sometimes it's a complex.
Plenty of smoke, but no cannon.
Yeah, there we go. But it's a hard job for some fans sometimes to work out, you know, okay, so there's a comic book with my favorite characters in. Is this canon? If it happened in the comic book, did it actually happen in the real life of this show?
Well, yeah, Superman, a prime example.
Yeah.
And what about the economics of this? If you look at the money made on a movie itself versus all this sort of the paratext that you're talking about, the trailers, the games, the business of the action figures.
Well, that was one of the motivating forces for me in writing this book. I mean, on two hands. One is that, you know, if we look at how much money these things produce, quite often they're the thing itself. So, you know, if you look at Disney, for instance, Disney tends to make way more money on its DVD sales, on its toys and merchandising than on the movie itself. And so if you asked, you know, a smart exec at Disney, you know, what's the thing itself and what's the product that you're selling, they'd probably tell you that the movie is the trailer for those things. And so, you know, and we're all familiar with this from, right, the 80s, that big wave of Transformers, yes. G.I. Joe, My Little Pony, where the it's shows the were there to sell the programs. Well, so, I mean, on one level, there's that sort of economic imperative where the industry cares about them sometimes more than the show. But on the other level, I sort of thought that, you know, precisely in the wake of those things like My Little Pony, you know, academics are aware that we're meant to be cynical of these things and say, oh, it's just hype. But I was interested in how they create not just profits, but meaning. And so, for instance, when you watch a trailer, you know, what does that tell you about the movie that you're about to watch? And or I say you're about to watch, but in many cases, it's the movie that you're not going to watch because you think you know it. You don't need to watch it.
Or the trailer convinced me that I don't want to watch it.
Exactly. And why do you feel confident in saying, I don't want to watch that movie? It's a bad movie. Because you've got a sense of the genre, you've got a sense of the characters, you know, the world that it's set in. All these things that the trailers created before you've even got to the movie itself. And so you're now responding to the movie on one level, but you're not really responding to the real movie because you haven't seen it.
Can you talk about the Onion parody that you include in your book? Because I thought that was a great way to talk about trailers and some of the power they have.
Yeah, no, there's this wonderful Onion News Network parody where what they do is they posit the idea that it's breaking entertainment news that the Iron Man trailer is going to be turned into a full-length feature film. And I think it really plays off the idea that, you know, that the Iron Man trailer was getting great circulation and people were really excited about it. And yet the clip, as you'll hear, sort of plays with this notion of fans sort of wanting some kind of loyalty to the original text. And yet here the original text is the
minimal
trailer.
Yeah, right.
Iron Man was one of the most popular trailers of last summer, but controversy is sweeping the fan community today following the announcement that Paramount Pictures is planning to adapt the beloved trailer into a feature-length motion picture. Here to discuss the details is Entertainment Weekly writer Rory Covey. Rory, good to see you again. I take it there's some mixed reaction to this news. What are they going to do?
The Iron Man trailer is near and dear to a lot of fans' hearts, so you can imagine how worried people are about this news. Apparently, the plan is to expand that fast montage of very short shots seen in the trailer into full-length, distinct scenes. And in between those scenes, they plan to add additional scenes that weren't in the trailer.
It just doesn't seem like that would work.
That's right. The fact is, it's very difficult to make the character, story, action that work in a 90-second format also work when they're stretched out to 80 or 90 minutes.
Why do you think the trailer was so popular?
Well, it does tell an amazing story, Michael. A cocksure billionaire industrialist and inventor is kidnapped, but turns on his captors by designing an amazing mechanized suit of armor, ultimately becoming a hero to the world. It is a breathtaking 90-second thrill ride.
Surely then, Paramount realizes the tremendous financial risk of alienating the trailer's core fan base if they don't embrace the film properly.
Exactly,
and
that's
right.
Why the studio has tried to reassure the public that everything that they love about the trailer will be incorporated into the movie adaptation, right down to actual lines from the trailer. And they are bringing Robert Downey Jr. back to reprise his role as Tony Stark.
Well, there would have been a real outcry if they had tried to cast someone else.
Yes, but that doesn't quell everyone's fears over whether the integrity of the trailer is in danger. For instance, the redheaded woman played by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Who's great.
She is great, and fans love her 3/4 of a second role. I mean, what if they gave her more lines or more scenes? Mm-hmm. I mean, who knows what they'll put in there between the point where he breaks out of the lab in the suit and the point where he flies in front of those jets. What if they put in a tedious romantic subplot that was 20 or 30 minutes long?
That doesn't sound good.
No.
Well, I guess we'll all be waiting to see how it actually turns out.
Yes. Luckily for us, Paramount has announced that it plans to release the movie in theaters along with a group of 8 entirely new entertainment-packed trailers to screen before the film. So even if the movie is no good, hopefully the trip to the theater will be worth it anyway.
Rory Covey, thanks for being with us today. We'll see
you
later on.
Okay.
In Seattle today, a man has bruised 23 people in a punching spree.
All right. Are you sure that's a satire? Are you sure that's not for real?
It's so I'm told, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of truth to it,
it's so close to what you really see.
Well, and what I love is it shows the degree to which, like, the film-going process begins long before we sit down and the curtains come across. It's so much of it is about anticipation, about what expectations we brought into the cinema and you know, what we're hoping to see and which characters we're hoping to see. And so what I'm really interested in is where do those expectations come from? Who creates them? What creates them?
Well, who has control over who's making the trailer and what goes into it?
Well, I mean, there's a controversy over this, right? I mean, I'm sure we've all had this experience of watching a trailer that we feel at the end we don't need to see the movie because it ruins the entire movie. There are some other examples you could give of trailers which, you know, are quite respectful. So that recently I saw Up, and one of the things I love about Up is that the trailer doesn't sort of spoil what happens about 10 minutes in. I won't spoil your audience either. And so it didn't sort of ruin the film for me. And what that shows, though, is that it's not the creators themselves who usually make the trailers. And sometimes the creators can be really angry with the sort of publicity that precedes their movies. So there's a New Yorker article that looked at the studio Lionsgate behind the W film that Oliver Stone did and how they look at how mad Oliver Stone was at the way in which the film was marketed. You know, he thought that he was doing something quite kind of serious, and yet they were marketing it as a sort of, you know, a play with stupid Bush and posters of, like, you know, Bush looking like the thinker and things. And they the marketing made it look almost sort of Michael Moore-esque when Stone wanted to create a tragic figure. And so sometimes you get this weird level of sort of a disjarring between what the trailer says you're about to see and what you actually see.
I've seen some trailers where they put all kinds of funny bits, but it turns out that was the only humor in the whole movie then when you see that.
Yeah.
They sort of take the good bits and you get the impression that there's a lot more coming, and sometimes there's not.
Yeah, and it's not just the good bits. It's also sometimes they lie to you about genre, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, another movie that I'd give an example, it's a bad movie, but M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. I think one of the reasons it did so poorly, other than just being bad, is that the trailer really set it up for a fall, and that the trailer led us all to believe we were going to watch a horror film. It had the sort of standard things that you see in a trailer for a horror film of sort of the rules of how to survive. And we saw this sort of the creature coming, and it's filmed in a way that we're expecting a horror film. And then if you watch the film, there are some elements of horror in it, but by and large, it's not there. I mean, sometimes the trailer creators feel the need to give a film a genre, and that can really work against a very sort of, you know, a movie like Shyamalan's that is trying to sort of play with ideas of genre. And so, you know, the more complex a creator you have, usually the worse a trailer you have.
Are there any trailers that you think sort of actually do work as almost like little mini films, sort of with merit in their own right?
Well, we just heard one of them, right? The Iron Man trailer, I think, is spectacular, and it got incredible reviews and so forth. I don't know. I guess any movie that I've decided not to see is probably because I feel the trailers told me all I need to. So I think in some degree they all do it. I can't point to a specific one on the spot, but yeah.
Now, you've flagged the film The Sweet Hereafter as being an example of an inferior trailer. So what's so great about the movie that this trailer we're about to hear doesn't catch?
Well, actually, maybe we could do it the other way. Hopefully, some of your listeners won't have seen the movie, and so we can sort of do the experiment the other way. What I'd like to do is sort of get you to play the trailer that played in America, and you're meant to guess what the movie's about. And then maybe afterwards we can talk about what the movie's actually about.
That sounds like fun.
It's dull in our town since my playmates left. I can't forget that I'm bereft of all the pleasant sights they see, which the piper also promised me.
In a town where no one is a stranger, in a place where everyone feels like family, something has happened that will change their lives forever.
I'm really sorry to come over unannounced like this, but it is important that we talk.
I'm a lawyer.
Do you hear about the accident?
As far as I'm concerned, there is no such thing as an accident.
Oh, geez. Now, one man must find the truth.
We must begin our investigation quickly. Things get covered up. People lie.
We're not country bumpkins. You can put the big city hustle on.
You're angry, Mr. Ansel. All I'm saying is,
Let me direct your rage.
But who can you trust when everyone has a secret?
No matter what I'm asked, I'll tell the truth.
It's not going to be easy, Nicole.
I won't lie.
Who can you blame when no one is innocent?
There's people pointing fingers and making side deals. We used to help each other because this was a community.
Oh God, I'm scared.
You leave the people of this town alone, you can't help.
You know, I think a trailer like that, and I haven't seen the movie, is even more vulnerable when you're just hearing the audio.
Yeah.
Because you don't have all the pictures to distract you from the dumb dialogue.
Yeah, and it's quite a beautifully filmed a movie too. So The Sweet Hereafter, it's a Canadian film by director Adam McGuigan. And I'm sure listening to that, you'd probably think that, okay, so some kind of detective drama. There's some
I thought Supernatural maybe with some of those things in there.
Yeah, and in fact, some of the images in that, that you see a sort of white light, and there's a sense of, I don't know, maybe there's some alien that's gotten involved. It sounds a bit like Wicker Man, right? But Wicker Man in the snow.
The music made it sound as if there's going to be some horror too.
Yeah, and there's also a sort of Pied Piper theme that goes through it, which suggests, you know, the sort of children being abducted or taken away.
Yeah, this innocence versus horror.
Yeah.
Dichotomy.
And then you get the Ian Holm character throughout that who's the one who's sort of the lawyer trying to get to the bottom of this. And it's there's a sort of a bit of a film noir kind of feel of, you know, the sort of one man trying to fight the system and trying to get down to the bottom of it. So, I mean, that's what you think you're going to get. What the movie is actually about, the accident, is it's set in a small town in which a school bus carrying all the children in the town has crashed, killing all but one. And there's a lawyer who comes to town trying to find some sort of lawsuit out of it. But there's no sense that there's anything other than it was a horrible accident. Hmm. And in fact, what's interesting is in the Canadian trailer, which it doesn't make sense to play it on radio because the Canadian trailer works not by voiceover but by title cards. But the title cards actually set it up much more accurately in that they say, you know, sometimes there is no truth to be found. Sometimes there are no answers. And so whereas the American trailer sort of tries to encourage audiences to look for, you know, what happened at the bottom of this, the Canadian trailer sort of accurately depicts that it's a really sad movie. It's just about the complete lack of meaning. And indeed, in the Canadian trailer, you actually see images that tell us what the accident is. And when I watched this in a cinema in Canada, the audience gasped as a group. I mean, it's quite horrifying. And so the Canadian trailer, I think, does a much more accurate job. Now, I mean, I should say if I'm comparing the two, it's not as though, you know, Canadians make better trailers. The thing the Canadians had working for them is that Adam McGuigan is a known quantity in Canada, and he's a known quantity as a quirky director. And so you only need to say it's an Adam McGuigan film, and people go, oh, okay. Whereas, you know, in America, he's not a known quantity, at least to the same degree. And so they needed to try and create some kind of genre. And so, you know, what we heard is the result, a sort of weird mix of film noir, and yet it's in the snow, so maybe it's film blanc. And the Wicker Man and horror and supernatural.
So it's a calculated sort of attempt to get more people to come by figuring out what genre is likely to draw more viewers.
Yeah, they have to put it into a box. And as I said earlier, that really doesn't work for movies that don't really fit easily into a box. You could think of how the Coen Brothers movies sometimes struggle through their trailers too, because again, you know, just like Fargo, similarly, it's sort of film blanc, right?
Yes, very much so. Film bleak, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think gender plays a role in how trailers are designed? If you've got a movie where, you know, you're trying to get more males to go to it or more females, I mean, because it seems as if sometimes trailers will really emphasize the violence, the action.
Their advertising campaigns in general, I find it interesting how often they really try to make an end run towards either a female audience or a male audience. Or sometimes they can get smart. That Lisa Kernan has this really interesting book called Coming Attractions, which is all about trailers. And one of the ones she looks at in there is the trailer for Rocky, which aimed itself completely at women.
Interesting. On the assumption, a boxing movie, that's different, isn't it?
But on the assumption that the guys in the house are going to know that it's for them, too. Right? It's a movie about boxing. You see images of people beating each other to a pulp.
Yes.
You know, what more do you need to give the guys? And so instead, the trailer is much more about sort of, you know, his relationship with Adrian. And it's a sort of more romantic and sort of, you know, plucking at the heartstrings.
I guess
so
it worked
forth.
That way. It certainly had good audiences and how many sequels?
Yeah. Well, and these days, of course, you know, you can quite often find multiple trailers being made and released on different TV channels and so forth to try and address different audiences. So Jerry Seinfeld's awful animated film B-Movie was probably the most overhyped movie in the history of the planet. And it had about 40 different versions of the trailers, one for each type of audience. It was trying to convince you that it was what you wanted, and then it was what your children wanted, and it was what your wife wanted or your husband. And
I like the trailer voice. It's always this sort of deep voice of God.
You can just
spot it.
In your ear, very much in your ear too.
Yeah.
And I love that idea too of that it always has to start the in a town where or in a world where, which again shows how it really needs to set the scene. It needs to transport you there. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of sort of advertising materials can do well in general is they really want to try and give you an experience. I mean, for me, one of the classic examples here is the Jaws poster, of the woman swimming along, ignorant to the fact that this massive thing is about
to
come.
Says it all.
And you know, I still have problems swimming in the ocean, not because of the movie, but because of that darn poster. That idea that this thing could be underneath me, which shows how successful it was. It created the sense of horror and fear before the movie even got to me.
Let's look at some opening credits and how they're used as packaging when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. We're with Jonathan Gray, who is informing us about this concept of how to sell shows separately, which is with promos and spoilers and other media paratexts, the subject of his recent book. There are so many components now to what we would still think of as the thing itself, mm-hmm. whether it's a film or the TV show, things that come way before to promote and things that go way after to market it. But one of the most traditional, really kind of the successor to the overture, is those opening credits, and they seem to be used more and more effectively in television and films.
Yeah, I mean the opening credit sequence is interesting, right? Because on one hand, you need to use it to try and introduce people who have never seen your show to the show. And so in 20 seconds or more sometimes, you're trying to give people a sense of, who the characters are, what the attitude of the show is, what the genre is, what are the relationships between different characters, and particularly complicated shows you can get a lot in there. So I think of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I think still holds the record for this. I challenge you to watch the original opening credits for that and count how many shots there are. You can't with the naked eye. You need to be able to pause it and slow it down. There are so many images because there's so many characters that it's trying to introduce you to, and it's trying to tell you that this is a show that's a gothic on one hand, but it's a teen drama on the other, and there's this witch, and she's in love with a werewolf, and blah, 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 blah.
Sounds like you'd be watching fireworks.
Yeah, there you go.
but I mean, for TV, a long shot would be about 3 seconds, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, and in the Buffy one, you get, about 2 or 3 shots per second. And so on one hand, you got to do this to introduce people who haven't seen the show. But it also serves as something of a, your example of the overture is a good one. For people who are coming back, it's sort of back to a beloved text. It's telling you to sort of get ready, and it's this sort of moment of anticipation and excitement, just like, the singing of the national anthem before a sports game or, the parting of the curtains. And it sort of transports you back from your regular life into the sort of world that you're about to, engage in once more.
You wonder how many people who record TV shows fast forward through the opening credits.
Yeah, and what I find interesting is since I do that, and yet I know a lot of people who when they watch them on DVDs, even if they're watching 8 in a row, they will watch the opening credit sequences all the time. You can think about how many people use those the theme songs too, and yeah, as phone rings and so forth. They take on a sort of ritualistic quality of quickly transporting you to that world or bringing that world into yours, if you will.
Do you have an example of like opening credits that we could hear?
Yeah, I mean one of the clear ones, just because it gives you it's very narrative based and so it works on radio, is The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which I think you could listen to it and hear the degree to which the rap tells you the kind of attitude of the show, and it introduces us to the character and the attitude we should expect from him. And so although this is the longer version of it, even in the shorter version, at the end of about 30 seconds, you really know what you're getting with this show.
Now Well, this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down. And I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air. In West Philadelphia, born and raised, on the playground is where I spent most of my days. Chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cool and all, shooting some b-ball outside of the school. When a couple of guys who were up to no good started making trouble in my neighborhood. I got in one little fight and my mom got scared and said, "You're moving with your auntie and uncle in Bel-Air." I begged and pleaded with her day after day, but she packed my suitcase and sent me on my way. She gave me a kiss and then she gave me my ticket. I put my Walkman on and said, "I might as well kick it. First class, yo, this is bad. Drinking orange juice out of a champagne glass. Is this what the people of Bel-Air living like? This might be all right." I whistled for a cab, and when it came near, the license plate said fresh and it had dice in the mirror. If anything, I could say that this cab was rare, but I thought, man, forget it. Yo, home's the Bel-Air. I pulled up to the house about 7 or 8, and I yelled to the cabbie, "Yo, home, smell you later." Looked at my kingdom, I was finally there to sit on my throne as the Prince of Bel-Air.
Well, it gives you the whole story. I mean, just like Jed Clampett, you know, back in 1962, you're getting the whole backstory.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think the other thing that they're trying to do is sometimes is give you a sense of the proper interpretation, you know, of how you're meant to make sense of this. Because, you know, a lot of audiences are misbehave and they read things in their own way. And so it's a good sort of weekly reminder of how you're meant to make sense of the characters and reminding you of the sort of world you're in and so forth.
It's funny because I've never actually really thought about the opening credits, the little ditties, whether it's Gilligan's Island or whatever the thing is that repeats the story the way that does. I haven't really thought of that as part of the show, you know, as kind of working to get you in a certain mind frame, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like the book cover, right? And although we're all told don't judge a book by its cover, the fact that we need to be told suggests that we do. And similarly with opening credit sequences, you can learn a lot and judge a lot just by what you're seeing.
The Simpsons does that sort of thing in a slightly different way. It's almost all visual except for, I suppose, Lisa's sax playing worked in there.
Yeah. And the Simpsons sort of introduces you to all the characters. It's got a very quirky soundtrack. You've got the mixture of your standard sort of sitcom characters, and so you know that this is domestic sitcom. And yet there are a few things that tell us that we're using animation logic, so that, you know, Homer pulls out a nuclear ingot that fell down the back of his shirt. And so we know that, you know, the rules of regular real life sort of logic aren't going to work. And also we get a sense of the irreverence that the show has, beginning with Bart always writing a different set of, lines.
Impertinent things on the blackboard.
Yeah. And so, you know, put all these things together. And again, we have a real sense of, you know, what kind of show to expect and what we're going to see.
Now, you wrote a whole book about The Simpsons, right?
Yeah. Well, my first book, it was really about intertextuality and about parody. I was really interested in sort of – just like here, you know, I'm interested in how paratexts create meaning before we get to the thing itself. And with The Simpsons, I used it as a case study in that book of looking at how parody works, of how, you know, when we have, for instance, a domestic family sitcom, how when we watch something like The Simpsons, it might change the way in which we then go back to and make sense of that. So once you've seen The Simpsons, it becomes hard to watch something like Full House without sort of, you know, smirking to yourself and thinking up some sort of, you know, amusing extra ditties there. Or similarly, you know, the perfect example of that would be The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, that it tries to create parodic meaning for the news, so that if you watch Jon Stewart regularly, it then becomes hard to watch the news without all those sort of meanings that Stewart gives you sort of opening the door and forcing their way in.
Right. And if you take The Simpsons and then apply it to sort of this book, the show sold separately, looking at sort of the paratext, what kinds of Simpson merchandise and Simpson spillovers and, you know, other ways that you can see the show affecting people?
The Simpsons has done it probably like no one other than Star Wars has, right? I mean, for so many years, too. I mean, right from the beginning, I think that The Simpsons proved the power of paratexts and of all those things that happen outside the text itself when it became a sort of bad object. it's hard to think of this now, but you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, the Simpsons was seen as very sort of rude and countercultural. And one of the key reasons of that
is rude and cultural.
Yeah. Well, there are many ruder things on TV now. You know, Family Guy and South Park.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Have rendered it
much more
small potatoes. But in the early days, you know, we had back when George Bush Sr. and Dan Quayle were talking about conservative family values and campaigning against television. You know, Dan Quayle took on Murphy Brown and Bush, as a Republican convention speech, said that we need more families like the Waltons and less like the Simpsons. And Barbara Bush repeated that line multiple times too. And all of a sudden, the Simpsons was rendered as sort of – it was put on the opposite end of the spectrum from Bush. And so if you were into sort of – if you weren't conservative and if you were fighting that image of family values, the Simpsons was now this sort of text to be held up.
Did it goose up the ratings when Bush did that?
Yeah, it helped. And the Simpsons came back with a nice quick response. They showed Bart watching that on TV, and then Bart said, hey, we're just like the Waltons. We're all struggling with this recession. So nice sort of touche.
You know, beware when you cross somebody who's in the media. They have immediate recourse.
Oh, don't fight a satirist or a parodist. You will always lose.
You talk about the T-shirt too.
Yeah, the T-shirt was the other thing that made it the inappropriate object, was you had these underachiever and proud of it man T-shirts that Bart had. And, you know, if you get the show and the sort of ethos that it has, you know that it's ironic. Bart isn't really proud of being an underachiever. He's just been called it. And so he sort of thinks as a badge of honor, well, fine, if you're going to say that, I'll just say I'm an underachiever and proud of it, man. And so they created these T-shirts and they sold en masse. And you had lots of parents and teachers and principals getting really upset about this and banning the Simpsons or any kind of Simpsons memorabilia from school. And so again, this power tax, the T-shirt, played a large role in creating this idea of the Simpsons as being this sort of very bad, inappropriate text, when in fact, if you look at some of the shows from the first few seasons, it's fairly mild.
Well, yeah, and there's a kind of a buoyancy to the family values in the loose sense of the word in The Simpsons. I mean, you know, Lisa and Marge tend to be the kind of moral center of gravity for the thing.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of challenges. You know, I mean, as you said, the young girl is the center of authority as opposed to the father. And you know, Marge is just a wonderful sort of product take on, you know, your June Cleaver figure who, you know, Marge seems to be a perfect June Cleaver. And yet, you know, once every sort of 8 or 9 episodes, she loses it and she, you know, either starts losing her hair or she gets a steroid addiction or something, because you get the sense of this poor woman driven to craziness by a, you know, it's an ideal sitcom wife with a real life family.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's simply more, for all of its satirical trappings, more realistic than something like Leave It to Beaver ever was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's more credible in its dark, goofy kind of way.
Well, and it's self-reflexive, and that's something that you see with a lot of the Simpsons merchandise too, is that it sort of plays with some of the sort of constructions of this so that you can buy Krusty brand seal of approval stickers that you can put on, you know, I guess, malfunctioning merchandise.
I noticed you mentioned it as kind of – you use the word left or left-leaning with The Simpsons. I'm just wondering how valid that is. I mean, it seems to satirize both parts of this political spectrum. I remember one scene in which a storm comes to Springfield, blows the top off the penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy who's about to be executed, you know, comes flying out and says, oh, well, you know, the Democrats were going to be elected and let me out anyway, ha, ha, ha. And then he hits a power line and that's the end of him. But they seem to be – how could they for 20 years or so get along just making fun of one side of the political spectrum?
Well, yeah, and they didn't. I mean, I think the writers' politics do tend to lean more left. But the show itself, as you say, takes on sort of all comers. But again, that's where I think the paratexts were quite central, was that right in its early days it was set up as being left. Mm-hmm. And it was set up by being leaning left by George Bush, who posited at the opposite end of conservative family values. And so what that also means is that you had fans and viewers who sort of took that up and sort of said, okay, fine. If this is a left-wing show, great. We like it. And so it's this idea, this ironic sort of instance of when the text perhaps isn't and the show perhaps isn't leaning one way or the other. But it seemed to lean that way because of the things that surround it.
The other show that you mentioned that has a lot of merchandise surrounding it is Star Wars. Mm. And there you get into the question of fans, sort of fan base. How does that play into it?
Well, I mean, Star Wars is really interesting, right? Because it came about in a sort of pre-VCR era. And so you have the first movie hitting in 1977, then the next one in 80, and then the next one in 1983. Now, you know, if any of you have small children, you know, just do this as a sort of experiment. See whether you can get them excited about something and then tell them you'll give them the next installment in 3 years. It's not really going to work, right? And yet we have this audience. It did work. Kids kept on coming back and they fell in love with it. And I think one of the reasons why they kept with it is because the toys filled the void. And so what you have, if you think of Star Wars as a sort of, you know, the thing itself, as soon as the first movie ended, the thing itself moved into the body of the toys. And so you had lots of kids playing with the toys and all this other Star Wars merchandise and memorabilia. And that kept their interest for a good 3 years. And I say there, but I should probably say are, because this was, you know, this was me. This was my generation. I was a Star Wars toy player. And if I'm honest, when I look back and think about my relationship with Star Wars, so much of it was constructed by those toys. I think it's also one of the reasons why, for instance, Star Wars is often seen as such a guy's movie. Even though Star Trek is sometimes seen as leaning a little more female, and indeed science fiction sort of has a fairly split audience, Star Wars, I think one of the reasons it's seen as such a guy's text is because those toys were being marketed towards boys. And so girls were being sent pretty clear messages. This isn't for you. You know, it was boys playing with the toys. And the toys had guns and, you know, they weren't about sort of, you know, the kind of social issues that you see like girls' toys usually aiming themselves.
Not so much about relationships, more about shooting stuff.
No, it wasn't about a car. It was about a car with weapons, you know, or a spaceship. And even if you read the backings of the toys, they were all posited in terms of people who were destroying things or engaged in intergalactic battle and all the kind of things that sort of posit themselves to a good sort of militaristic, you know, boy youth kind of way of being.
You even mentioned that the colors chosen emphasize that. In the
packaging. Lots of blues and blacks. And I remember the FAO Schwartz in New York, the huge toy store, right up until about 5-6 years ago, if you wanted to go to the Star Wars section, which still existed, you had to go through a tunnel of G.I. Joe. And then you got into this area that was all blue and black on the floor, and it was very much for guys, as opposed to, you know, a few meters away you had the Barbie room with pink on the floor and so forth. So again, you have this instance in which, you know, a movie was marketed towards and sold to the boys, partly because of all the things around it.
We're going to look at some other aspects of marketing films and TV shows when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Jonathan Gray, whose recent book is Show Sold Separately, Promos, Spoilers, and Other Media Paratexts. We've been talking about various things like trailers, opening credits, toys, all kinds of marketing gimmicks that go along with the release of a film. Another thing that seems to be more and more a feature in recent years is the marketing of a DVD that has extra features that you wouldn't see if you just went to the theater.
Yeah, and what's interesting is how they're marketed often. They're marketed as, you know, in terms of movies, it's the director's cut or, you know, the platinum edition, making you believe that this is the real thing itself.
Finally.
And to the point of, I mean, one of the more interesting examples here is Blade Runner, that you have this sort of going back and forth with Blade Runner, the different versions, and fans talked about, and the versions made quite a difference because the central character of Deckard, what was at stake is whether he was or wasn't a human. And the different versions gave different clues towards this. And so for 20 years, you had this promise of Ridley Scott releasing a DVD that would give you his definitive version, because even the director's cut as it was marketed wasn't Scott's. And then finally it comes out. And so you have this interesting situation in which the real text takes about 20 years to come. And there have been fans of this thing all along, and yet they've never seen that which they were often waiting for, holding out for, this the sort of perfect version.
Well, you get these director's commentaries too, where you can watch the entire film with audio of the director commenting his or her way through it.
Yeah, and so again, you know, directors can start to try and sort of put their imprint on the movie and on your consumption of it, so that as I said with opening credit sequences, there's an element of them giving you a proper interpretation. You know, the Fight Club DVD is interesting, for instance, because Fight Club has a fairly homoerotic tone to it that many viewers have picked up on. And yet the DVD goes out of its way to
disavow that.
Exactly, disavow it and to tell you, no, that's inappropriate. And so now you want to go forward with that reading, it's an inappropriate reading. And similarly, you know, the other thing that these DVDs can do is, and the commentary tracks, is they can play a role in insisting that what you're watching is a wonderful work of art.
Well, yes, that's right. Well, for example, you can have those artist interviews or director or writer interviews saying how wonderful this person or that person is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got a few examples from Pushing Daisies.
So for that, with that information, we kind of set up for that shot because it took a while to set it up. And she really thought about it, and she thought about it, got herself in the place. That's what I love about working with Anna, is that she will really put herself in the place she needs to be for the scene. She doesn't expect to kind of just do it when we're rolling. And she kind of sets her, and there's no lines or anything, but the way she opens up her eyes, you can just see the focus and the heartbreak that she's feeling on that shot. That's what I always see on that shot. I think the shot's great, but I can just see that kind of complicated despair that she's feeling. It's true.
So that's just a producer kind of promoting the work?
Yeah, and well, it's actually what you hear there is Lee Pace, the star of Pushing Daisies, who's being interviewed with Brian Fuller, the creator, talking about the other lead actress, which is Anna Friel, and talking about this scene and you know, glowing about how good her performance is. And it's interesting, you know, when we see this particularly with TV. I mean, I think a large number of people are now accept that film is an art with capital A. Film sort of has been allowed into the club. TV still maybe not so much. And DVDs make an interesting case for why TV should be considered art. You know, first you have statements like this where our eyes are being drawn to the sort of nuances of the performance. You could think of, you know, when you go to an art gallery or a museum that has an audio tour and it tells you how you're meant to, you know, appreciate the thing in front of you. That's what a lot of these DVD bonus materials are sometimes doing. And so as a result, they try to sort of play up the artistic value of what you're watching. Sometimes they'll give you production stills. They'll give you all these interviews with the various sort of the people involved with the film or TV show, right down to the sort of the level of, you know, the guy holding the mic. I think of here the DVDs for the Lord of the Rings series interview pretty much everyone involved with and to try and state, look, this is real art. And so there's a lot at stake then when you see that with blockbusters, which are often not seen as art, or with television, which again aren't seen as art.
You also can find ones that have bloopers or deleted scenes or things that sort of take serious-looking actors and show them in not-so-serious moments.
Yeah, and I mean the research suggests that that's what most people actually want in their DVDs, that all these commentary tracks. Yeah, and most commentary tracks, apparently the research is that the very few people care about them. But again, there's a sort of interesting nod and a wink being given to your fan base of sort of, okay, we'll show you what our actors are like as real people. We'll show you them sort of playing around and goofing around on the set. And so, again, what the DVDs are trying to do maybe is not in those situations demand that what you're watching is art, but try and strengthen the relationship between the TV show or the film and the fans, and try to sort of, you know, make it a stronger bond, which, you know, of course the producers hope will pay off in terms of you giving them more money.
Well, those deleted scenes actually can, I think, contribute to the sense of art in a piece. When you say it might be a perfectly good scene, and yet somehow it slows down the plot or somehow just doesn't quite hold together the way it should. It helps you to contrast the final product with the steps leading up to it.
Yeah, no, definitely. And there's a large amount of sort of production literacy that's taught
right
through these. Again, I think of that Lord of the Rings DVDs. I learned all sorts of, you know, vocabulary, and I learned what a gaffe was, and I learned, you know, what the best boy did, and all those things that you don't understand about films, you get a sense of. And as you said, with the deleted scenes, which you get almost an hour worth on Lord of the Rings, you get a real sense of perhaps what the vision was behind it, or how
right
a vision is crafted.
The subtitles have a kind of interesting role that way too. I find that reading them gives me a better idea of how the actors think when they deliver their lines.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to see how the difference between the line and the emphasis.
I would think some of this would get into some complicated legal questions in terms of ownership of a brand or a trademark. For example, if you just take something like Sesame Street, and you can find it on balloons, on birthday cake designs, you know, Tickle Me Elmo, just everywhere, shirts and so on. If you take any given film, how is it controlled in terms of who can use what and do what with it?
Yeah, it's hard. It you know, we go back to Star Wars. Those toys opened up a sort of new era of merchandising. And I don't think the industry fully understood the Pandora's box they were opening. Because if you think about it, what they were saying is, look, you can do what you want with this text. Here are the sort of toys. Now create your own stories, create your own meanings. Go ahead, play. And now they find themselves going, no, please don't play in these certain ways. And if you do, we'll sue you. But the box was open. And so on one level, you know, the industry then finds itself having to control, as you said, how fans use it and make sure that, for instance, you don't put their characters into a fan fiction piece in which, you know, the characters are having a gay relationship, which is something you'll quite often see in fan fiction. But it also creates a problem just within the industry itself, in that often the people who make the DVDs are not the creators themselves. The people who make, you know, some spin-off games are not the people themselves. And so you have this entity that sort of needs to be reined in. And I did some interviews with producers and found that it's a very chaotic system by and large. A lot of the people making, for instance, spin-off, you know, video games, they have no idea of what the plot is like. They don't know much about the characters. They're given scant information, and they're meant to try and create within the world with this. And so it's kind of a haphazard system at the moment. There are only a few franchises that have really got it right and that really have worked out how to do what we sometimes call transmedia storytelling, when you tell the story across various media, using each of those media as a sort of important link in the chain.
With some kind of consistency.
Yeah, so that you don't just have, you know, things double backing on themselves and all of a sudden this character is this way. And I think of just on a simple level, you know, I used to read comics as a kid, and it was always amazing to see how from episode to episode the characters changed their look just because a different artist was drawing them. And so, you know, someone who had no real biceps last week is, now looks like Schwarzenegger. And what we have is that problem writ large with transmedia storytelling, is that you have these stories that are just different artists get involved and they take it in different ways.
One of your chapters is called Spoiled and Mashed Up. And I've seen in the book world things like, you know, Pride and Prejudice and zombies and all kinds of weird mixing of things. In the film world, what would be an example of a mashup?
Well, you see them online quite often. People sometimes play around with a trailer for a film, so that there was this great competition this company in New York did, asking people to remix a trailer for a famous film and change the genre. So The Shining changes from being a horror to being Shining, a feel-good movie about a father and a son trying to bond together. Or West Side Story becomes a 28 Days Later styled zombie film. So
it's
you get
New
those...
York after all.
Exactly.
Pretty grim place. I would think part of this whole process, which only comes once a year, but there's plenty of hype before and after, would be the Oscars.
Mm. Yeah, and the Oscar buzz and Oscar hype is it quite often comes after the movie got its first round of hype. And so it's a way to repurpose some of these movies. Sometimes because, you know, the nominations may take some of the studios by surprise.
Oh, I think quite often.
And so the way they marketed it the first time, they now realize, ooh, we can market it this way another time. You know, I mean, I fully expect Hurt Locker, for instance, to be marketed as something that women should get out and see because it's the first movie that's ever gotten
directed by a woman to win the best picture.
Exactly.
And
yet,
she beat out her ex-husband to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So it seems like, you know, and as in cheesy fashion the Oscars are wont to do, when she walked off the stage, the band was playing I Am Woman, giving you the full cue into how this is going to be marketed. Particularly, here was a movie about war. And so you know that it probably wasn't being marketed as too heavily towards women the first time around, as much as it probably will be the second time around.
Do you think that this sort of all this hype, the paratext that you've been talking about, that it hurts the sort of genuine independent film that just is a movie?
It can make it very hard for it to be heard. But at the same time, I found it interesting that every time I talk to people about this project, I often have people very proudly say, oh, I don't watch the hype, or I hate movies with hype. But everything has hype. An independent movie, for instance, will get nowhere unless it has a great review in the New York Times, or unless it has a really evocative movie poster, or unless, some Finnish film director glows about it in an interview in a prominent magazine. Everything has its hype. And so it's just a matter of where that hype comes from and what form it takes. But it certainly makes it hard to be heard. You really have to stand up on a table and scream and shout in Hollywood for anyone to know that you're there.
So where do you think this transmedia storytelling is going to go? Is it going to get out of control, or is there a good future for it?
Well, I hope there's a good future for it. What I would like to see is Hollywood realize that they can tell stories across these venues and that there's a lot to be gained for them and for their audiences if they can really rein in these various sort of sites at which you can tell something. So rather than it being sort of sloppy and slapdash, or rather than it only working in instances like The Simpsons, which is such a sort of disparate world that anyone can contribute to it, it might be really interesting if they can take tight plots and start to think about ways in which those plots can work across some of these venues. Now, I realize there are a lot of audiences who don't want to follow a text across those various venues, and that's going to be the big challenge is how do you make it interesting for those who will follow you without making it a requirement for those others so that they don't feel it's like homework. But it'll be interesting to see how they work with that and how it works at a contractual level too, because I'd like to see the people who create these things get paid properly too, which at the moment they're not usually.
Our guest has been Jonathan Gray. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.